Over the past 18 months, the pandemic's acted as a catalyst for jolting shifts in economic and social policy across the globe. Alongside this, trust in governments reached record highs, particularly in Asia. Troubling times do need governing. After all, we've learned that. Surely this presents an opportunity for governments of all persuasions to reflect on their purpose, to forge policies and paths that could set us up better for the future when we can eventually approach, COVID as just another annual flu. Yet this possibility talk arrives when governance in Australia has deteriorated. Well, that at least is the message from a man whose opinion we've learned to digest, John Daly, the inaugural head of the Grattan Institute think tank, who released his last report earlier this week called Gridlock, Removing Barriers to Policy Reform. So let's talk about something other than COVID this morning. Let's explore some big issues facing our governments and us citizens in the immediate future. And I'm happy to welcome John and Dr. Julianne Schultz, who's also stepping down, as is John, from her foundation role at the Griffith Review Journal after, I think, is it 12 years, Julianne? Is it?
I think it's longer.
It's longer.
It's 17.
17, sorry, pardon me. And she's written a revealing essay also exploring our futures about the state of our nation called Facing Foundational Wrongs. And I'd like to welcome you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, yours is not a pretty diagnosis. Are we locked into the predicaments you describe?
I think we are at the moment because we have seen a steady deterioration in our institutions of government, and that means they don't work as well as they used to. We've seen increases in the powers of vested interests. We've seen a very substantial transfer of power from the public service to political advisors. We've seen a shift in the way that media works. And the consequence of all of these kinds of shifts is that we politicians simply no longer attempt to do reforms that are unpopular, and some good reforms are unpopular. They are increasingly driven by tribal beliefs, what we call shibboleths, and they continue to not do things that are opposed by powerful vested interests if the serious work has not been done by independent reviews to show why those vested interests are wrong, and we're not commissioning enough of those kind of reviews to ensure that we make progress on those issues. And there are structural reasons in our governance why we're not doing any of those things, and there's not a lot of pressure to change how the country is governed.
I must say, you do say that evidence, if people are presented with evidence, which is goes to your point about commissioning people to think about it, evidence does matter and it can shift things.
Yeah, it was something I was really surprised about. I went into this report expecting that I was going to find that vested interests got their wicked way a lot of the time. And you certainly see very powerful interests, vested interests in everything from climate change debate to pretty much anywhere you look in healthcare to pretty much anything you do in superannuation. Those vested interests are obvious. The thing that was really surprising when we did the analysis was that actually, those vested interests had lost quite often, but they lost if and only if there was that kind of independent evidence to counter them. And I've spoken to a number of senior public servants, and apparently the dynamic essentially runs like this. Public servants show up in front of the minister and say, "Minister, we think it would be in the public interest to do X." And the minister turns to the lobby group and says, "So what do you think about this?" And the lobby group says, "Minister, if you do that, the sky would fall in. And what would these public servants know? They're not on the ground like us." And the minister says, "That's right, so we're not going to do it." But if, on the other hand, the public servants turn around and say, "But Minister, on page 23 of this independent review that went into this industry in detail, it says that the sky is not going to fall in," then the minister turns around to the lobby group and says, "Well, look, you're just a vested interest talking your own book. Go away. We're going to do this." So it really does make a difference because of the internal dynamic to government.
Hmm. And just before I come to Julianne, and so is it partly just those that structural change you've described, the sheer amount of noise that's around, does it mean that the politics of this, the perception that something's unpopular, the amount of effort I will have to devote if I want a reform is not worth it? Is there an exhaustion, I suppose, component in government these days that we didn't see before?
I think there's two things going on. There's one, which is the media and an exhaustion, and there's no question that the mountain looks a little bit higher than it used to. But I think there's something else which is internal to politics, which is much more serious. So we now have a political class. We have people who essentially do student politics when they're at university, and then they become advisors, and then they get pre-selected, and then they become members of parliament. And then after they finish being members of parliament, and they no doubt hope ministers, they go and work for government relations firms or in some kind of government relations role, or perhaps, you know, as directors of government boards. And so their entire life is essentially part of politics and part of the party. And those people have very limited incentives to rock the boat, because if they rock the boat, then they're essentially putting their entire career at risk. We are no longer a country in which we have a prime minister who actually drove a train, as Ben Chifley did. And so because of this professionalisation of the political class, we've seen rapid expansions in both the number and power of political advisers. And those political advisers are really focused on how do I help my minister win the media war in the next 24 hours. They are not trained to think about long-term policy, and all their incentives are to think about the short term. And because the minister is now spending so much time listening to them rather than public servants, whose job it is, at least in theory, to talk about the long term a lot more, they get much less advice. And then at the same time, we've also massively weakened the public service. So we now have appointments that are much less based on, you know, who would really, really be the best person for the job. And much more seriously, we now have the powerful ministers to essentially fire their secretaries anytime they feel like it. And something like a third of all Commonwealth parliamentary secretaries have been effectively fired over the last 20 years.
Now, Julianne, in fact, you do sort of, you know, bastardise, I suppose, the Clinton, it's the economy, stupid, which is what ran around very much in the 90s. And you say it's politics, stupid. So that is, so we've come to that in your view, have we?
Look, I think we have. And I mean, I think that many of the points that John's made, I'd absolutely agree with. I think one of the things that's interesting is, that I would just add to his sort of description of the sort of ideas process, in a sense, is what has happened in this country over the last 25 years has been an endless process of inquiries, reports, royal commissions, expert groups, Senate and committees. There's been an enormous amount of work done by people who are knowledgeable, who've had, you know, constructive engagements with the public service and so on, to come up with serious, thoughtful proposals and recommendations, and hardly any of them have ever been implemented. Now, part of that is for the reasons that John's outlined, but I think there's an underlying sort of bigger question as well. And that is that when we've had big periods of sort of nation-defining change or reform, you know, right back to Federation, you know, the sort of the notion of a sort of inward-looking country was a very deliberate choice that was made at the time. The period after the Second World War, when Reconstruction was on, was a very deliberate, serious choice. Mm. The period of expanding rights, you know, in the sort of Whitlam period, was a very deliberate choice. And then the period of sort of neoliberalism that followed, again, was a deliberate choice. And in all of those cases, they were an Australian reflection of debates that were happening around the world. And I think that what we've seen in the last little while, especially, is there's not been clear guidance that we can take from elsewhere. And so there's a bit of a sort of, oh, do we do with this or we'd go there? You know, what is the defining sort of central idea? And, I mean, one of the big problems that stopped that, you know, taking that next step is that the big international movements around climate and sustainability and different modes of globalisation, we've just closed the door on those discussions. And so where they could be levers for some really exciting and important new sort of areas of reform, both in economics and in sort of social and other relations as well, we've just said no. And so we've sort of cut ourselves off in a way from the big drivers of change that we're really now starting to see emerging internationally in a serious way.
Well, in fact, your essay, because you come at this diagnosis of us from a slightly different perspective, really, your essay talks about a moral deficit in Australian politics that harks all the way back to our Federation Parliament times. So can you expand on this, please?
Yeah. Look, when I've been trying to think through how the idea of Australia has taken shape, which is the book that I've been working on, and And in doing that, I really had to go back and look at some of the sort of formative, you know, elements that, that have occurred along the way. And I must say, when I went back and read a lot of the Federation Parliament debates, I mean, I'd known about White Australia policy, I'd known about the deportation of South Sea Islanders. I hadn't really understood that the giving women the vote was a political deal. It wasn't something that was sort of grasped as a sort of foundational policy. And I realised as I was doing that, that so many of these sort of old things that were deeply ingrained in the country had never really thoroughly been addressed. And so they're able to bubble back up. You know, sort of the metaphor I use is like groundwater, that they bubble up in times of crisis and difficulty. And we find ourselves repeating lines that could have been said 120 years ago and going, where did that come from? How do we get there? Mm-hmm. And in all of those questions, you know, there is a sort of moral dimension. And, I mean, going even further back, you know, into settlement and colonial periods and so on, there's always been a reluctance, you know, which is sort of awful to say, but a reluctance in a way to go back to first principles. You know, what was actually going on, for instance, you know, in the earlier settlement, that international best practice at the 1788 was to sign treaties, was to do deals, was to pay compensation. That didn't happen, and it never got addressed. And we're still having that discussion now, you know, 2021.
Well, in a way, John Daly, I think you say that we have tried to counter some of this, of what Julianne's talking about, to see inspired people have set up institutions that really matter. In fact, one of the key things you say is that history is not just about great men and women, but about structures and institutions. And you think ours are falling short, do you?
I think ours are weakening. So if you look at what we've seen happen, for example, around pork barrelling over the last couple of years now, it's very clear that many of the conventions we used to have are essentially being weakened. If you look at the conventions we used to have about ministerial responsibility in terms of ministers resigning if there was, you know, a serious problem in their portfolio or a serious problem in their past, ministers simply don't resign anymore. They just tough it out. And to take two very concrete examples, Ros Kelly resigned a little over 20 years ago for a sports rorts affair that frankly seems pretty tame by contemporary comparisons. And we've just had a robo-debt catastrophe in which cost the Commonwealth a large amount of money. It clearly behaved illegally. You know, many people have been very, very badly affected, put through enormous emotional trauma. It certainly appears that it's probably contributed to a number of suicides, and not a single person has taken responsibility or has fallen on their sword for it. Now, that's a very substantial deterioration in the standards that we used to hold our politics to. And the problem with those conventions is they are just conventions. There's no law to them. You're reliant on everybody in the system complying with those conventions, and as soon as they disappear, then governance doesn't work nearly as well as it used to, because those conventions are very much part of governance. And then in terms of how the black letter stuff is working, FOI has become essentially now completely emasculated by governments taking these what can only be described as extremely broad definition of what counts as a cabinet document. You sort of wave it underneath the cabinet trolley and apparently it's suddenly a cabinet document. All of these things are starting to fall apart.
Yeah, and one listener's rung in and talked about political donations and lobbying, I presume, also would fall into this category. So this is all part of your issue about checks and balances and who watches the checks and balances.
That's absolutely right. And those things have become much larger. And to be fair, a number of the states have put things in place that are actually going to that are actually making a difference on both donations and lobbying. And indeed, one of the interesting things is that Commonwealth politicians will tell you that if you, you know, put any controls on donations or lobbying more than we've got at the moment, the sky will fall in. And my observation would be that the sky is holding up perfectly well in New South Wales and Queensland right at the moment, even though they've done these things. So, yes, we know what we should be doing in terms of regulating and controlling these things. They're extremely popular to put these controls in place, but our politicians simply refuse to do it, particularly particularly at the Commonwealth level.
Yeah, see, Julianne, it's interesting, you know, you quote Prime Minister Edmund Barton in the middle of the first year of the century, firmly grounded the new nation in the, quote, instinct of self-preservation quickened by experience, which is quite, and you know, there's a little tension in your piece because you sort of say there was this almost this utopia, search, a belief that we were creating a utopia, at the same time as sort of having rather low expectations of what we could achieve, that we were hanging off England and so on. So there's this paradox there, I think, that you identify.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting that, you know, that at one point Utopia was the proposed name for Canberra. And so my original title for the essay was Our Utopia, you know, rather ironically, be careful what you wish for, because the record hasn't been as great as it might. I mean, one of the interesting things is that at the time of Federation, somebody's done a big survey which looked at the sort of science fiction or the sort of futurist novel fiction that was being written at the time in Australia and Canada and the UK. And Australia, by a mile, had much more dystopian sort of fiction than anywhere else. You know, people were quite fearful, which I think is the other element of what John's talking about in terms of institutions. I mean, part of the problem has been that we have seen institutions weakened by their own bad behaviour. You know, we've seen those sort of royal commissions that have revealed that many of the sort of foundational institutions have actually not lived up to what our expectations were of them. So that's a problem. But the other thing which I'm really intrigued by is that I think that culture leads politics. And so if you look at what's happening on the ground, you look at the art sector is so devastated at the moment, but you look at the sort of informed conversations and discussions that people are having. I mean, watch the drama on any given night, for instance, and you hear a discussion which is quite a long way away from what is happening in the sort of mainstream political debate.
Quite.
So that tension between what the people are saying, what they say in surveys, what they say in polls is hugely different from what politicians are prepared to say, because it's that inability in a way. I mean, the thing I say in my piece is that we're good on mission statements, you know, get elected, good on KPIs, this is what we'll deliver for our mates or, you know, where we've made promises, but we're really bad on vision.
Yeah, well,
and that's what I'd like to see the discussion around, really.
And John, I'll give you the final word. Can this be rectified?
I think it can. I think that these institutions can be changed, and it's not going to solve every problem, but it will definitely push us in the right direction. And I think Julianne's absolutely right. Politics is never about utopia, or at least it shouldn't be. It's about making the world better. So we can change these institutions. Some of them have been changed by the major political parties in some of our states. And often it's independents who push for change, because when they hold the balance of power, almost always the thing they ask for is a series of institutional improvements that then have really long-lasting effects on the prosperity of the country.
Like a federal ICAC.
That would be a very good place to start.
Okay. All right. Well, look, this is very much a snapshot of your very thoughtful pieces from both of you. I thank you very much, John Daly. Thank you for being the inaugural chair, chief of the Grattan Institute, of which I sit on the board. I'll just declare that. Thank you. Congratulations, John.
Thank you.
And Julianne Schultz, thank you to you.
Thank you, Geraldine.